This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. The Ebola virus was garnering headlines even before the first cases hit the U.S., with nearly 5,000 people killed in West Africa. And now that it's here, the coverage has been simply overwhelming. So what does Ebola mean for the workplace? And just how concerned should employers be about its risks? On this podcast, we'll delve into those questions and more with Philadelphia employment attorney Jonathan Siegel. Jonathan represents employers and is the managing principal of the Duane Morris Institute, which provides training for human resource professionals, in-house counsel, and managers on a myriad of labor and employment issues. He also has been a featured speaker at numerous national, state, and local HR conferences and serves as legislative director for the Pennsylvania State Council of SHRM. And he's appeared as a commentator on key employment issues on CNN, PBS, and other outlets. Jonathan, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, David. Thank you.
Jonathan, I'll start with this. You did a Twitter chat about this very subject recently on Ebola and the workplace, and there were people posting messages wondering, hey, what's the big deal, saying the media had really blown it out of all proportion. So how do you see it? Is this really an issue that employers need to be concerned about at this juncture?
There are some that say this is much to do about nothing, and that's very wrong. If you're in healthcare, if you are a hotel laundry worker, anyone that could come into contact with body fluids, this is a very real issue. There are safeguards that are in place that people should be ideally following in terms of bloodborne pathogens generally. So the concepts here is nothing new, but there are some aspects of it that are different, and the CDC has imposed guidance that's specific to Ebola. So in certain areas, it's something that's a major risk. If you are an office worker, the risk is much lower. There shouldn't be sharing of body fluids, and I'll be no more specific than that. The primary risk is a blood spill, and even if an employer is not covered by OSHA's bloodborne pathogen standard, the principles underlying it of latex gloves and using sodium hypochlorite, Clorox, to cleanse the area, for the most part, does the trick. You know, David, you get a lawyer, and we always say, I'm not giving legal advice. I think this is the only time I need to say I'm not giving infection control advice either. But there is a reality that there are steps that every employer can take. So it's a bit of a risk continuum. In some areas, it's a higher risk, healthcare being one. The average office building, less so. A manufacturing plant where there are more accidents and the potential for blood spill, somewhere in the middle.
So with that said, should employers be saying anything to their employees at this point relating to Ebola or coming out with policies?
Employers are all over the map on this, and that's not a criticism in any way. It really in part depends on the level of concern, spoken or unspoken. I have clients where individuals are extraordinarily concerned. Some of them are healthcare providers, and that shouldn't be a surprise. We know of the work stoppage in New York. We hear people asking questions, and I think in those situations, dealing with it head on can be helpful. But I think some of these organizations are doing is saying, look, we want to provide some education to you, so that you can understand why we are taking the actions we're taking, and also why we're not doing what we're not doing, why we're not quarantining people or telling people they have to report if they've gone to a particular area or removing people from the workplace or asking if anyone has a particular condition. It really depends on the workplace. I think except for the higher risk industries, I'm seeing most employers low-key it. So it's my belief of what people tend to believe, that the risk is not as great as originally thought. First of all, I got to be a human being before I'm a lawyer. It's hit here only recently, and tragically one person died, and one is a tragedy. but thousands have died in Africa. So even if it doesn't spread here, and I pray it doesn't, it's still a problem. But I think people don't see it as likely to spread here as the initial fear begins to wane a bit. If there had been a wave of individuals coming down with it, I think you would have seen a lot greater of a response.
I wanted to ask you about Casey Hickox, the nurse who was quarantined in a tent in New Jersey and later sued the state of Maine over its quarantine of her. That really shed a spotlight on the government's struggles to balance public safety concerns with individual rights. Do you see a concern that people might be isolated out of fear rather than health-related reasons?
Historically, the 10th Amendment is reserved to the states, the police power, and with that dealing with responses to emergencies, which is why you see the states going to the feds for natural disasters, earthquakes, floods, and the like. The same thing is true here, which is why New York, California, New Jersey, Georgia, various states have come up with their own rules, and they have a right to issue under various statutes that have been enacted rules. It can be a quarantine or an isolation. I didn't know the difference, so I'll just say isolation is taking those who have Ebola and separating them. Quarantine would be those that are considered at higher risk and separating them. And the general principle is that the state, for the most part, has the right to do that. There are some general principles that need to be based on scientific evidence, not irrational fear. There has to be a process by which individuals can challenge it. And the case in Maine is an example of how the system works. A quarantine was issued. The person went to court, challenged it, exercised their due process right, and the decision was to modify the quarantine. So the states have a fair amount of flexibility here, and when people say, you know, why is it this way, it's part of all powers that are not given to the government reserved to the states, and this is one that the states can respond to, and the hope is that the states will respond to scientific evidence and not irrational fear. Where there's irrational fear, individuals can go to the courts, as we saw in Maine.
Jonathan, what about employers, particularly healthcare employers right now? What special precautions should they take?
Well, the healthcare employers, and you really hit those that have the greatest concern, they absolutely, number one, need to make sure that they're following infection control in general, including personal protective equipment in particular, and there are some tweaks that are specifically recommended by the CDC for healthcare. And what's sometimes missing is the importance of emphasizing the training in healthcare. And again, one of the risks can be that a healthcare worker could try to take off the gown, the mask, the PPE, and infect themselves in the process. So the supervision of the donning and doffing, that is putting on and taking off the protective gear, is a very important part of it.
Jonathan, is there anything else you'd like to add on that issue?
The sort of million-dollar issue, and it may be a litigation issue, is can a healthcare provider require that individuals disclose if they have Ebola or if they are at various risk levels with Ebola? And under the EOC guidelines, regulations relative to the ADA and the guidance which they've given, generally speaking, you can only make medical inquiries if the individual poses a direct threat. And direct threat is a standard for requirements: duration of the risk, nature and severity, likelihood of potential harm, and imminence of potential harm. It's a tough standard to meet. Yet, if you're a healthcare worker, those words may sound nice, but may not particularly resonate well with you emotionally. And if you're a patient, you could reasonably say, you know, I want to go to a hospital where I don't have a risk of being infected. So patients are in hospitals automatically being isolated, not quarantined. And hospitals, if there are hospitals that are specifically kind of magnets for Ebola and you just can't ship them, you have to make sure that you stabilize them and do everything you can, including making sure that all the appropriate records go with them before you send them to an Ebola treatment center. But, you know, there is a question. Can you ask healthcare workers, what do you have? And the ADA is on the one side of the equation, the direct threat standard. On the other side of the equation is, what if you don't ask a healthcare worker affects a patient because they cut themselves and somehow that spills into the unprotected mucous membrane of a patient, not likely but possible, then you could have a wrongful death claim and you're balancing a potential wrongful removal claim versus a wrongful death claim, not to mention the death of the hospital from a public relations claim. I think there's three potential areas. Do you ask about Ebola? Do you ask about his symptoms, or do you ask about potential exposures? The CDC has talked about potential exposures, and they've divided them into four categories: high risk, some risk, low risk, and no risk. And it would be reasonable, not risk-free, to say if you have certain symptoms, you need to report them. Someone could argue with Ebola that's akin to asking them whether they have Ebola. You could ask whether they're a high-risk person. That would be exposure to blood or body fluids of a person with Ebola simply having visited a country where there's widespread Ebola but no known exposure. It's not zero, but it's a low risk. So I think there you would run into a significant ADA issue and potentially a discrimination issue. You can mitigate the ADA risk if you set, number one, by obviously making sure you keep it confidential for ADA and HIPAA, as well as HIPAA reasons. And two, you might say, if you have Ebola, we need to know so that we can isolate you from patients. There's a risk. EOC might agree with it. There's a risk in not doing it. If you have the symptoms, or if you're high risk of exposure based on the CDC guidelines. And in those circumstances, three of the categories that I think are the most palatable from a sort of humanistic perspective, you ask to report, you don't stigmatize, you simply say, under these circumstances, we don't want you coming to work until either you don't have it or the 21-day incubation period is over. We don't want this to be punitive, so we're going to pay you for the time period.
Now, you mentioned that direct safety threat to others defense under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And could an employer cite that and ask an employee who it fears might have the virus or order that employee to stay home for 21 days? And if so, what would it need to show?
What you want to do is you always want to rely on medical advice. So if you say, I want this individual to stay home, you'd have to show that there's a significant risk of substantial harm to others. It's a very tough standard to meet. I believe the EOC probably would say the direct threat standard is not met now in a hospital, but to me, where hospitals can get in trouble with the EOC or in the courts is blanket rules. So if you said, anyone that went to any of the three Western African countries where there's high exposure, not all of West Africa, it's not all of Africa, Nigeria, by the way, is Ebola-free, that's a problem. But if you stick to the high-risk areas and then you focus only on those positions where there's the capability of potential transmission, even if it's not as likely as the EOC might want, then I think you have at least a defensible argument. It's not a blanket rule. You made an individualized assessment based on the circumstances and on the position. And I would add that in some cases, there's an irony here. Legal irony is not like a favorite topic, but I'll throw it in anyway. If you're a hospital, you almost want the state to give you rules. Because although the federal government can argue they're preempted by federal law, if a state says any healthcare worker that has Ebola or symptoms of Ebola or high-risk exposure cannot be in an acute care hospital, then you don't risk your license. and you remove the individual. So there's an irony in this area that, you know, employers generally don't say, you know, regulate me, I need more. Healthcare is highly regulated, but if a state says these are the rules that are going to apply in healthcare, these are individuals that you need to remove from your workplace if you're a healthcare provider, then although the EOC could still come in and say this state law goes too far, they're going to have to challenge a state law. If you do it alone without a law behind you, then you should at least be checking with an infection control expert. So if ever you're challenged and you're in court and you're before a jury, you can say, well, it's not just what I read on the CDC website. You check with a specialist. You ask them their advice. You say, are there any positions that you recommend I not allow individuals to have contact with patients? What would those positions be, and who would those people be? Ebola, symptoms of Ebola, high-risk exposure to Ebola.
Jonathan, obviously healthcare is where these stories are getting the most attention, but are there any other high-risk professions that you're seeing with Ebola?
I'll tell you, David, I'm doing all the reading on the healthcare because, you know, maybe I'm a frustrated doctor, and I find it fascinating, and helping people survive tragedies feels good, even if you're only ancillary part of it. I haven't read all the stuff from morticians, but funeral directors and funeral homes need to take a look at this because they're dealing with it. Emergency response workers need to deal with this. You know, 911 workers need to deal with this. People that are, and I think sometimes painfully forgotten, you have people looking at the highly educated nurses, and I hope that they get the time and attention they deserve, but I hope that the cleaning service that picks up the laundry from the hospitals and other providers, that those individuals get the care, that the custodians that are cleaning bathrooms and other areas, someone throws up in a store, they're cleaning it up. I hope that they're not just taking a towel and cleaning up the vomit. The bloodborne pathogen standard talks about bloodborne pathogens. Well, first of all, I don't need a standard to tell me I'm not cleaning up anybody else's vomit, including my own, without gloves on. But those are issues you really want to focus on because it could be literally life and death. How? That custodial employee has an open wound on their hand, and through that open wound, the vomit, which has the Ebola virus in it, enters their system. Does that result in an automatic conversion to Ebola? I'm not sure that's 100% clear. Some studies on the immune system, on how strong it is in fighting it off, and also affecting on how effective the medication is in recovery. But I think you can't look only at healthcare. It should be a critical area, but not the only area.
Let's turn things around a bit. Are there any circumstances that would permit a worker to skip out of work out of fear of contracting the virus?
It's a great question, David, and in New York, there was this strike under the National Labor Relations Act and under OSHA. But if there's a serious safety risk by objective standards, employees don't have to expose themselves to it. And in fact, even if there's a union contract, they have a right to refuse to under, it's a case called Gateway Coal. So if you said to a nurse, you got to take care of this patient, and you didn't give him PPE or there weren't gloves, they would have a right to refuse. If you said to someone that was an EMT, we have a patient and they're in the ambulance and the individual is vomiting all over the place and there's not goggles, there's not everything to cover up where there is mucous membranes, then they would probably say, "Have a right, I'm not going to go in." So there potentially would be circumstances if there's not adequate protection and there's not adequate training. What you want to do, I think, in those circumstances is to make sure the controls are in place, do the training, explain what it's based upon, give people an opportunity to answer questions. Everyone wants to keep costs down, but I'm a big believer, even if you're healthcare, it's sometimes helpful to get someone from another institution, unless you're highly recognized in this area, so people know it's someone that doesn't have a, quote, vested interest in your staying for economic reasons. And do the training and make sure people understand it. And if someone says, look, I'm not doing it, rather than saying, okay, you don't have to, a real simple question. Why? We've looked at the CDC guidance and others on infection control. We've looked at the special guidance the Joint Committee has come out with. Is there more that you think we should be doing that's scientifically based? And then the person says, no, I'm just afraid. Well, then the question is, do you have to accommodate that anxiety that's not based in science? And I think the answer is most probably no. You can tell the person they need to do the job.
Well, I was going to ask you a question about OSHA, as we have just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to get your thoughts on whether that agency needs to come out with new regulations, either in response to Ebola or just infectious diseases in the workplace generally.
It takes time, and the process is proposal, if it's regulation, and then comment. They can issue guidance without going through the regulatory process, which is what the EOC did, for example, in pregnancy. OSHA did issue special guidance that if someone Googles OSHA and Ebola, it'll come right up. But what it effectively does is refer people back to the bloodborne pathogens standard. And my concern is that doesn't apply to every employer, but yet every employer could have a blood spill. So some of the principles, not all of them, would apply to all employers. This is a bit of a political hot potato, to be direct. So I think you see the federal agencies not acting with the same dispatch as some of the states. One could say that's in part for political reasons. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying some are. Some could say it's because of the 10th Amendment, which says this is a state issue and not a federal issue unless the states don't resolve it. This is a prediction. I don't think you're going to see an Ebola standard from OSHA, something, you know, beyond comply with CDC, comply with what's in effect, follow best practices as they come out.
Jonathan, what other implications do you see out there?
The real, real important thing that I think employers need to do, healthcare and others, is continue to stay tuned, continue to look for developments. And I think in workplaces often of the dance of anxiety, that employees understandably have anxiety, even if it's not scientifically based. People don't know what they don't know, and what they see is really scary. And one way you can allay the anxiety is if you, number one, do education, even if people aren't raising it. Have a brown bag lunch for those who may want to attend. Remind employees that the EAP is there if individuals have questions. And consistently stay on top of things so that when changes occur, they hear it from you, not from someone who knows very little and sends out a tweet or something or posts something. And as we all know, some of the stuff that's out there isn't accurate. There's one thing I didn't say that I think is really important, but it's really important for employers to say, I'm sharing with you the best available scientific and medical evidence I can find. I can't give you specific medical advice. No one can give anyone a guarantee. And if you have any questions or you have any symptoms, you really should go to your doctor. You don't want to somehow warrant that your workplace is entirely free of any risk. And in the process of focusing on Ebola, not a bad time to remind people of the flu, because we've had, tragically in the U.S., if we look only at the U.S., one Ebola death, but we'll probably have 20 flu-related deaths this year, many of which can be avoided if people just receive the vaccine.
Yeah, that's a great point to finish on with flu season upon us. Well, Jonathan, this topic is one that certainly we could go on and on about, but I really appreciate your insights and enlightening our listeners today.
I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate your asking me to be part of this. Thank you very much.
Jonathan Siegel is a partner at Duane Morris in Philadelphia, where he represents employers, including hospitals, and also provides training for HR professionals, in-house counsel, and others. I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on key employment topics, including how the NFL flunked HR 101, and much more. The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice. nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR, our new employee handbook resource, and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. And if you mention listening to this podcast, we'll give you 20% off a new subscription. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.